Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
Radio City Talk.
We have got a fabulous guest on the programme to talk through an incredible life and an incredible challenge that lays ahead. We're going to be talking about a million and one different things. We're going to be talking about amputation. We're going to be talking about suicide. We're going to be talking about cancer. There's many different aspects to the story of Damien Harper, and who better than Damien himself to set those details out for us on the programme today. Damien, thank you for your time. Great to see you.
Yeah, thanks for asking me, Mick, and thanks for that introduction.
We are going to explore your journey so far, and it's an incredible journey. We're also going to talk about what you've got planned as well. Climbing Mount Kilimanjaro itself,
yeah,
quite the challenge.
Just a little bit.
We're going to be hearing over the course of the next half hour, 45 minutes or so, why it's even more so of a challenge for yourself. You're running it.
I'd like to.
Let's not get carried away.
Yeah.
You're completing the challenge and looking to complete the challenge for the Amputation Foundation.
Yes, so that's correct.
Can we talk about the amputation just to start off with?
The foundation? Or...
No, just in terms of you and how...
Oh, how it came about.
And how it came about.
Okay. Well, it happened a long time ago now. I'm in my 33rd amputiversary year, so it was 33 years ago it happened to me. I'd just finished my O-levels. I'd done really well. Full life on the cusp of adulthood, moving into a brave new world, as I thought. And just through the summer holidays after I'd finished my O-levels, I developed a slight limp. Nothing I was worried about, nothing too painful. It was just a dull ache in my left leg. And that went on for about 6 months. And I really never paid it any heed, to be honest. But my mother was getting rather worried because she'd noticed that I was limping quite pronouncedly. And it was hurting when I was running or standing on it for a while. And after me trying to put her off for quite a while, she dragged me to the local A&E in the old St. Helens Hospital on a momentous day for me. And yeah, it's a pop quiz for you. It was the 28th of January 1986. What else happened on that day?
The 28th of January 1986. Now, I was born on the 25th of April 1982.
Being four's no excuse, Mick.
28th, 86. So was it a cup final day?
No, it was something a bit more dramatic than that. It was the day the Challenger shuttle exploded.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and that was the day I got dragged, I think it was a Tuesday, by my mum to the local A&E. Thought nothing of it, saw one of the doctors in triage. He pulled and prodded my knee, probably said it was growing pains because I'd grown about 12 inches in 12 months. I remember looking up to all my friends at the start of the fifth form, whatever year that is now, I don't know, in terms of year 12 or whatever. And by the end of the year, I was as tall as them, so gone from about 5'2" to 6'1" in the space of 12 months. I even got stretch marks on my back because my skin couldn't grow. So they just kind of put it down to growing pains. Said may have some ligament damage because I used to run everywhere. I was like cross-country champion for school, played for rugby, played badminton, did all kinds of sports, quite active. So they sent me for a check x-ray, still totally unperturbed by that really. And started getting worried a bit when they took about five different x-rays. Normally it's just one quick x-ray, check the x-ray, yeah, that's okay. And they kept taking it from different angles, and I thought it was odd when the radiographer came back with us to A&E with the x-ray films in a brown envelope, which normally doesn't happen. I broke my wrist a few times and things before, so I kind of knew what the routine was. And then got back to the main A&E and basically all hell broke loose. So the doctors running around phoning other people and speaking to people, and I was saying to my mum, well, what's going on? And she said, I don't know, but I could see the worry on her face. I got admitted to hospital straight away. Which was a bit of a surprise. No going home, nothing, straight to hospital. So I got sent to Whiston, was admitted to Whiston, and was basically told the next day that I had cancer. So I'd gone from this 16-year-old lad on the cusp of adulthood, just doing well at my A-levels, had great aspirations to become a chemical engineer. That was only because it was the most well-paid job in the careers booklet at the time. It wasn't because of any sort of great aspiration. So I had the life of my life in front of me at the age of 16, and then being told I had cancer the following day.
Cancer, so it was within your bones?
Yeah, it's a specific kind. So actually, one in a million people get it. So with all the other attributes I've got, my friends call me lucky because, you know, it's had a big impact in many other ways as well. So about one in a million people get it, and it's really difficult to diagnose because it happens predominantly in young adolescents. We were growing quickly, and I think that's part of the problem, is the cancer cells slip through because your bones are growing so quickly. So it develops primarily in your bone. It's very difficult to treat. The chemotherapy that they have for it is brutal, to say the least. I'll probably come on to that in a little bit later. But so it just shows you never take tomorrow for granted, really. And that's kind of, as I've got older now, I'm 50 now. And this happened when I was 17, actually. You kind of appreciate the time that you're here because you never know what's going to happen. But unfortunately, it wasn't that straightforward. When I went into hospital, was told, based on the x-rays that they'd done and the symptoms, that they were 95% sure that it was osteosarcoma, it's called, bone cancer. And then they did biopsies on it, and I had to wait for 2 weeks on bed rest in hospital because they have to decalcify the bones before they can look at it in this whole involved process. And then we came back and the consultant just called us in, or came in to see us one Friday afternoon, and very laconically just said, you've just cracked your bone.
Oh, wow.
There's nothing wrong with you. Off you go and live your life. So obviously, I didn't hang around to be sort of question anything. I was out of the scalded rat.
What I mean, after all that worry and all that concern, so to be told that, and you can go and enjoy your summer as a young man.
Yeah, so I thought, bring it on. So we went home. So that was probably getting towards the end of, no, middle of February, that would have been. So I went home on crutches, and then progressively over the next 2 months, my leg just kept swelling and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I got stretch marks around my knee. It was literally the size of a beach ball, and I was as thin as a lap then. I was really skinny. And then my parents just said, this is ridiculous now. It's, you know, it's obviously not getting better. I had all the scar had started to open up. So I went back, and it was just before a bank holiday Easter weekend, and a different consultant saw me, took one look at my leg, took one look at my x-rays, and said, that's 100% osteosarcoma. Which obviously I thought, because I kept reassuring myself before I went back to the hospital, well, we know what it can't be, because we've had tests for that and they've said it's not that. And he said, I don't even need to do a biopsy, I know exactly what it is. I don't know why you've been sent home in the first place. Now, the downside to that is, because the symptoms are not very specific, people tend to have this bone cancer for quite a while before it actually gets diagnosed. And because they've done a biopsy in my bone, it'd given a nice hole for the tumour to come out of. So it grew out of my, because it was only at the top of my knee, just at the side of my kneecap on my left-hand side. And by the time I went back, it travelled. You could literally feel the tumour in my leg, literally growing up my leg. So that was incredibly traumatic. I remember sort of collapsing on the bed when the consultant sort of basically said that. And he don't mince the words, even though I was only a young lad with my dad. And he said, I don't need to do any more investigations on this. I know what it is straight away. So that was bad. I don't remember too much about the next couple of weeks because I was in loads of pain. I did have another biopsy and it just confirmed what they thought. But one of the problems with bone cancer is that it has a really predilection for spreading to the lungs prior to diagnosis of the main tumour. And the survival rates for bone cancer, even today, haven't really changed in the intervening 30 years. It's still 50-50. And if it spreads to your lungs, it's probably nearer about 20%. So it's very, very difficult to treat. It's very resistant to treatment. So how I'm still here today, when lots of my friends who had the same diagnosis at the time, who were around about the same age or maybe a bit younger, who weren't or didn't have it as extensively as I did, are all dead. And that sort of really, I still carry guilt about that now, about why I survived and they didn't really. And that's just a kind of burden I have to carry. So to cut a long story short, they said there's no option but to amputate. And I thought at the time it would be sort of mid-thigh, somewhere like that. And then Wendy told me, we're going to have to take half your pelvis and all of your leg as well. I mean, I didn't realise what the impact of that would be, because it's only later now I've become a bit more aware of sort of the implications of amputation and just how serious that was. So had the amputation, they didn't have to take half my pelvis, which was good news. And then had hell for the next year on chemotherapy, which was really, because you're growing, the way the chemotherapy works is it attacks cells that are dividing quickly, so they take more basically poison. But when you're 17, all of you is growing quickly, so it makes it really, really toxic. So I lost all my hair, constant nausea. I was 6'1" and weighed about I think it was 5.5 stone. It was, and the baldness was difficult to deal with because it's very dehumanising. I remember asking my mum to take them. I had a mirror in my bedroom because I used to be very careful about my image, if you like. I used to have the blonde mullet that was a fashion in the 80s. And that all went, and I couldn't stand looking at myself, so I asked her to take the mirror out of the bedroom, which was just making me feel even worse. So then I didn't really know how to deal with it emotionally. Mm. I was very sort of naive and immature in sort of emotional development at the time. This was back in 1986, 87, so there was really no charities, no counselling services, nothing like that. And I didn't really know how to handle it and how to deal with it. So I basically put into a big black box in my head, and I had a very dissociative relationship with it, and it was as though it happened to somebody else. And I thought, well, crack on. It was one of the things that was really difficult is I was doing really well at my A-levels and expected to do well and get a good career, etc. And then all my friends who I'd grown up with since, you know, the beginning of senior school, they'd all finished their A-levels and then went off to university. So I was totally on my own. So all my friends had gone. I had no sort of support emotionally. I didn't really want to burden my parents with any extra worry because they were obviously out of their minds. So I thought, well, I best just crack on. So I finished my last chemotherapy session in September of 86. By February 87, I'd passed my driving test, got a car and got a full-time job. So I'd only just got my hair back when I started getting, when I got my job. And ironically, the job that I got was at the hospital where I'd had me, I was at Whiston Hospital, where I had my amputation, and I ended up becoming a trainee medical laboratory scientific officer, which was an MLSO, to those in the know, it's a biomedical scientist now. And it's, so I worked in the lab where I had all my diagnosis and everything. So and did well. Met with my beautiful fiance, who we've been together for now 29 years. I don't know how she's brought me for that long. That's Sue. We live at home with our beautiful Labrador Barney. She told me to say that.
Big shout to Barney.
Yeah, so, and then I cracked on, qualified as a biomedical scientist, got involved in the IT system when we were putting, we were getting computerised. So I did that for about 17 years. Really never thought about my amputation or what had happened to me so much. And got on with my life as best I could.
We're going to move on now, Damien, if you're comfortable doing so, with sort of what happened next. So you've gone through this tremendously difficult time, 16, 17, 18 years of age.
Yeah.
But then you find yourself in a relatively short space of time in work and back in the workplace with a prosthetic. Did you have at that
time?
Yeah,
I'd got a prosthetic. The initial ones weren't very good. They're very uncomfortable, very heavy as well, because I've lost all my joints.
Well, can I ask you about that? Because if anyone looks at your Twitter picture, you can see sort of the shape of your body is now post-amputation. I think a lot of people have kind of got used to seeing sort of soldiers who've lost just above or just below the leg. Yours appears to go right up into the sort of the almost like the ball of the hip.
I've had I don't have any hip bone. They've taken the hip bone out, so I've lost everything. So on my left hand side, I finish on my bum. And there's very few of us. I think there's about 100,000 amputees in the UK, roughly. Only about 2% of people are my level of amputation. About 50% of those don't bother with the prosthetic just because it's so uncomfortable and it's so heavy. And either resort to crutches or wheelchairs, which for me, it was untenable. I couldn't do that because it takes your hands away and you can't really carry anything. So
what sort of movement are you able to get
out
in terms of yourself now, in terms of your sort of, not your flexibility as such, and we're going to come on to the fact you're going to climb Kilimanjaro, but in terms of are you comfortable in the way that you're able to move on it now?
It's a lot better now. Myself personally, with the socket they used to have was made out of leather, and it basically used to encompass the entirety of your lower pelvis.
Right.
So it was called a bucket. You used to sit in this and it was horrible. It was made of leather. It was like when you get a brand new pair of like leather brogues and they're really, really uncomfortable. Well, can you imagine having that around your waist? So when you're trying to bend down, cut you in half. So what I've done over the last few years is try and improve that design. So I do a lot of internet searching and horizon scanning for new things. So I found this guy in America called Jay Martin, who runs a company called Martin Bionics. And he's an exceptional guy. He's an entrepreneur, but he's a trained prosthetist, and he's developed this new concept. So I found his website and showed it to my prosthetist at Aintree. I said, can we have a go at making this? And it's called a bikini because compared to a bucket, there's a hell of a lot less of it, and it works so much better. So they're never comfortable. You know, it's not something you can say it's like a comfy pair of slippers, but it's tolerable, and it makes the leg work a lot better. So I'm quite proud of that now, because that's becoming kind of the de facto standard now for new people. So we're going to hopefully, because this bone cancer is still happening, people are still losing limbs at that level, who are young. So trying to make prosthetics that are more usable helps them as well, which I'm quite proud of, actually.
We're focused on the physical aspects of this and fixing you and putting you back together with the bucket. And the system, and then the bikini system on that as well. We're going to touch on something now which comes with often the stigma, which we absolutely try and tackle on this show. But it's such, for me, a key part of your journey. Yeah. And I think even yourself have kind of noticed that the mental impact on something like this is almost as big as the physical impact as well, if not bigger. At what point did you think, having put everything in a box, as you mentioned before, that actually there were issues that you hadn't dealt with, that there was something else going on here that was outside of the physical rebuilding process?
I think, in a way, I kind of always carried it. I just didn't process it, as they keep telling me now. I just isolated it off, segregated it off, put it in a black box, and tried to ignore it by getting on with bunny ears, normal, whatever normal is, and cracked on with my life, like I said. But then I put up with it for a long time, but over the time, the enormity of kind of what happened to me started to sort of dawn on me, if you like. It sounds a bit silly, but I couldn't have children because of the chemotherapy. I wasn't offered any sort of semen salvage or anything like that. So that meant I couldn't have kids. It's ruining my remaining joints. You know, they've had 30 odd years of one leg being worn, and then my back starting to have problems. And then about 5 years ago, my mother got diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and there was a lot of other, I was under a lot of pressure at work. I had a really good job by this time. I was working all over the world, you know, traveling internationally. And then there was other pressures as well. And I basically, it all, my little black box, my Pandora's box, exploded. And once it came out, all these memories and unprocessed images and experiences and emotions had come out, and I couldn't put them back in the box. And that in many ways, it was more difficult to deal with than the cancer. I mean, I'm still struggling, to be honest. I'm just learning ways now to navigate around it. So I know when I'm starting to go through a bad phase and I can intervene or seek help eventually. So that's kind of when, I'd kind of knew it was there but ignored it. But then about 5 years ago, it all blew up, and I've been struggling really since then with mental health. I've been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, like certain songs from 1986. If there was a guy opposite me in the bed on the ward, and he used to always play these two songs on repeat. So if I'm ever driving along now and I hear one of those songs coming off, it's 1986, I'm back on the ward in the summer having chemo, throwing up with her, you know. So and it's vivid. I can remember every detail about it, and it doesn't half take you breath away sometimes. So that's kind of what I'm still trying to deal with, and the just total hopelessness sometimes. You know, I've been in really bad places that you don't want to go, and you can't take a step back from sometimes. So
I think when people sort of talk about dealing with those situations as well, there's a sense, particularly with things like post-traumatic stress disorder, because it's associated so strongly with the military, that it's, you see something, and then when you try to return to normal life, it can't be unseen, and it hits you straight away. But actually, from what you're saying there, age-wise, you'd almost lived, well, you'd lived your life over again, if you like.
And that's what came as such a shock, really, because I thought this was 33 years ago. It was probably about 28 years ago, because when it started like 5 years ago. And I thought, why am I being so affected now by things that happened a lifetime ago, effectively? And I still don't know the answer to that, really. It's just that I've got these, I think, I saw a doctor recently, and I think he hit the nail on the head. Because I rushed to get back to normality so quickly after it happened, I never grieved for what my losses were. So I had a particular life plan that had been snatched away from me. I had a quarter of my body basically hacked off and thrown in an incinerator. You know, there's no sort of grand state ceremony for any amputated limbs. So I'd never really gone through that grieving phase. So I'd parked it all at that stage and never processed it. So now, as of for the last 5 years, I've been, you know, seeking counselling and stuff. And these things and these emotions and these feelings are starting to be teased out. And I'm having to process them and actually revisit those thoughts and emotions to try and, I don't think I'll ever accept it, but be comfortable or relaxed about it instead of it causing me sort of panic attacks, which it has done in the past.
Even when people on this programme talk about the fact that they're open to the idea of, you know, counselling, therapies, whatever form of therapy that might be, I guess it's still difficult to say, you know, well, let's open the box. Let's let the box stay open then, and let's deal with the stuff in the box. Let's sort out the box.
Yeah.
Is the part of you, you know, a percentage of you that still thinks, well, you know what? I managed to keep a lid on it for so long. If I could just prise that box shut just a little bit.
A little bit. But I think it's always been there at the back of the mind, and it's been a bit like a millstone around my neck. So although it's difficult to confront it, I don't think, like I said, I'll ever fully come to terms with it. But if I can be comfortable with it and not resent, because I've got loads of resentment and anger about why it happened. A lot of things went wrong. A lot of things were handled badly. And I'm realising now that that anger only hurts me, and that resentment, you know, doesn't affect anybody else. So I'm trying to purge those demons in a variety of ways, really. I don't want to put it back in the box. Because they'll still be there. So I know it's difficult, but I think if I come, I am part way through the journey now. It's not like it's as raw as it was, say, a few years ago. But like this Pandora's box has been opened, and all these demons, and the analogy I like to use is once Pandora's box has been opened and all this hell comes out, well, what's left at the end? And what's left at the end is hope. And that's what I am going for now. And I'm doing that in a variety of different ways. I'm doing like lots of charity work at the moment, I'm trying to turn my negative experiences into positive experiences for new people.
Can I ask you about that? You're obviously wearing the branding for the Amputation Foundation today, and you're going to walk Mount Kilimanjaro as well. Have you found connections within organisations like that? People who have maybe not the same story, but actually have got echoes and tones that are the same as stories which fit your tone. And has that been helpful in that regard?
It's been brilliant, really. I think probably when I hit rock bottom, I did a few things. Like I appeared on that TV show and I had my picture taken by Rankin, which was kind of reigniting a glowing ember of the normal me, and that gave me confidence to do things. So I applied for a scholarship that came up on my Facebook feed, and it's Flying Scholarship for Disabled People, which it says everybody thinks it's about flying. And I didn't really look at that. I looked at what the tagline was on their mission statements. And it's basically saying to rebuild people who've lost self-belief and self-esteem. So when I turned up, it's quite rigorous. It's about £15,000 per scholarship. So it's quite, you have to be quite intensive in the scrutiny of people who apply. And I think I threw them quite a lot because they were asking me about planes. I said, well, I'm not really that bothered about flying planes. I'm more interested in what you've said in your mission statements. I want to get me back. I want to get my self-esteem back and my self-belief back. And the fact that it's done through a medium of flying was kind of a bonus. So I was brutally honest with them, and I got the scholarship. They thanked me for being candid and just saying, thanks for not saying what you think we need to hear. So I had a fabulous experience with that. I can take off, fly planes fantastically. Can't land them, but so I'll be up there for a while. But that was a brilliant experience. But the point I was going to make was that was for people who had any kind of a disability. And one of the selection processes, we had to go to RAF Cranwell in Lincolnshire to go through the final screening stage, where you had to go through like interviews and etc. with the trustees. And it was a 3-day residential course, and we all had, you know, vastly different disabilities and conditions. But once we got talking, like in the evenings, even though people had vastly different disabilities, we all came back to the same mental health issues that we had. You'd listen to somebody speaking and say, he's saying what I'm feeling. So despite what your differences are, there is commonality, and having that empathy with somebody else helps enormously, because you think, well, I'm not mad. I'm not just being stupid. I don't need just to get on with it and run it off. You know, it's not like, and that helped enormously. So what, since I became involved with the Amputation Foundation, I started going as a sort of client, if you like, and then they asked me to become a trustee about 12 months ago. And I've took on board the lessons that I learned from the FSDP and tried to apply those things, because they work really well for me, to the Amputation Foundation, which is one of the reasons why I'm trying to raise funds, because you can see people blossom, particularly when we have coffee mornings once every Friday, last Friday in every month at Ruskin Drive in St. Helens, and we even get people down pre-amputation now. So we can advise them, and because if you're in that situation when you're in a hospital, and the doctor comes and says, I'm afraid you're going to have to lose your leg, doctors aren't really up to speed with what the prosthetic, the very disparate type of disciplines, if you like. So they give lots of misinformation and lots of bad information. So we've had a couple of people come down who were nervous, they were frightened, and it's all ages, from kids up to pensioners. And they can sit with people who are amputees like myself, who've been an amputee for a very long time. And there's hundreds of years' experience now within that group. So it's a very informal, friendly session. Everybody's welcome. We sometimes have speakers on as well. And you can see people relax, and they come in and they're nervous, and they don't really know what to do. And then they'll start talking about what's happened to them. And somebody said, oh, well, you need to ask this, and you need to try that. And it's just guiding people through that pathway. And for me, that is food for the soul. That makes me feel like that my life and my being has got some worth and some value now, whereas when I was in the sort of depths of depression, I felt the exact opposite. I just felt like I had no value and nothing left to give, which is why I'm thrilled that they asked me to be a trustee, and actually now we're doing things to try and enhance those activities that help people. If you'll bear with me, one of the big things that we did last year, we had we've only been a formal charity. The organisation was set up by a guy called Steve Cruz, who's a double-o-knee amputee, lost his legs in a car accident in Australia. And he was working with an organisation called AIM that was set up with Andy Reid from St. Helens, war veteran who's a triple amputee, and a lady called Jackie Palmer, who set up AIM, but that was a community interest, not-for-profit company. And that was going really well. It was a similar kind of thing. But then it was growing and growing and growing, and we were paying 20% tax on all our donations. So you'd have to ask Steve what his real incentive was, but they thought it should be a proper charity. So we're now a registered charity. We've just submitted our first year's accounts. But we held a big gala dinner ball as our official launch at the Titanic Hotel last March, which we had over 300 people there. It was a fantastic night, and we raised quite a lot of money. So at the trustees board meeting, I suggested that we do something sort of big to sort of, you know, announce ourselves on the stage, as it were. So there's this place in the Lake District called Calvert Trust. It's up near Keswick, just opposite Bassenthwaite Lake. And it's basically an outward bound centre that caters specifically for disabled people. It's not an outward bound centre that's had bits tagged on. It's been built from the ground up over the last 40 years, specifically to cater for people with quite severe disabilities as well. So we paid for that in entirety, and we took 18 amputees who were all strangers from all around the country. Nobody knew each other, and that was one of the things. And it was a four-day, it was a Friday to Monday weekend. Everybody was very nervous when they turned up. And after about an hour, it was as though they'd been friends for life. And then all the activities, we were trying to push people to give them that self-belief back, like I got from the Calvert Trust, and that little bit of self-esteem with support from peers. It's not like you've got an able-bodied person telling an amputee that they can do things. It's amputees telling amputees that they can do things.
And of course, the Lake District are home of some beautiful lakes, Bassenthwaite included, but also some beautiful mountains.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about mountains next,
yeah,
if that's okay.
Okay.
Because you've gone a little bit bigger than Blencathra,
yeah,
or Skiddaw,
yeah,
which are at the foot of Keswick. You mentioned the Lake District, lovely part of the world, the Lake District, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely.
But you obviously saw those mountains and thought, well, we could go higher than this. So just in the last, and this is like recently, the last yeah, few weeks, you've signed up to do a Mount Kilimanjaro challenge, which is basically the challenge is climb Mount Kilimanjaro.
Yeah, it's only 19,500 feet. You'll be walking the park. Not. Yeah, it's been organised by another organisation that we collaborate with other amputee organisations around the country. Each of us has a sort of special niche area. And this one's been organised by an organisation or a charity called Limpower. They're based more southern, I don't know where they are. It's run by a wonderful lady called Kira Roche, who I know personally now. And I think using the local vernacular, I gegged in and I said, can I come along? But I want to raise money for my charity, the Amputation Foundation. So she graciously agreed. And I've managed to tag my beautiful fiancé in as well. So she's coming with me as well.
And did she get a vote in that?
I've got to ask somebody to carry some of this stuff for me. We both thought it would be something nice for us to do together, because a lot of these things that I've been doing on my own rather than as a couple. And there are other able-bodied people coming. We've got like physios and doctors as well who are able-bodied to help us out.
What are they saying to you, the sort of the, quote, experts about the challenge that you face? Because climbing a big mountain is a challenge for anyone. But when you've had amputation and the way you've had amputation as well, are people saying, oh, well, you might have to stop, or you might only get so far, or you're going to feel like X, Y, or Z?
Yeah, I mean, people have died. It's no small undertaking. Climbing it, it's not to be, I'm making light of it, but it's going to be really, really difficult. But then, in my view, nothing worthwhile is easy. But I have spoken to my GP. I did speak to him about it before I left, and he said, you'll be fine. And we are taking, we're over there for 11 days. And I think 8 days of that are the actual climb. So it's not climbing per se. It's not like we're going to be scaling cliffs or anything. It's the largest freestanding mountain in the world, but it's an extinct volcano. So it's a very cone shaped. So it's going to be difficult. I think we have to climb about 2,000 feet vertically every day. But it's been done before. It's been done by people at my level of amputation before. I've seen a guy with no legs basically walk up on his hands to do it. So it's not to be underestimated, but then it's also achievable. And we're going on, it's the longest route, the Rongai Trail that we're going on. But it's the easiest route as well. And we've got a rest day built in. I think we've only got to do about a mile and a half on one of the days. And then the rest of the days basically to acclimatise and then push on. I think the hardest day is going to be the last day, because you have to get to the mountain top while the snow's still hard. So we have to set off at midnight to crawl, crutch, hop, by whatever means necessary to get to the top. But then the benefit of that is that you see the sunrise over Kenya and Tanzania. So I think that will be quite memorable. So
that is going to be quite something. I'm absolutely certain of it. Can I ask you about all those things that you've started undertaking, be it the flying, the photography work that you were doing with Rankin, climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. You mentioned before this idea that you were dealing with things in the past and you know your life was in a different direction now. Do you feel like these opportunities that you're taking are redefining you?
Yeah, absolutely. As I'm getting older, when I was young, I was on a council sink estate in St Helens. I'm not saying we were destitute, but we never really had a lot of money. I was always the kid with the crap trainers from the market rather than the Adidas Samba or anything like that. So I was very money orientated when I was younger. And, I was really successful in that. I ended up really quite senior level in the organisation I was working for. But then since everything that's happened to me, money isn't everything. You'll never have enough. So I'm trying to pursue a more altruistic thing where I'm helping. I get so much emotional joy out of seeing other people come on. Like Calvert, when we took people up to Calvert, there were people who wouldn't say boo to a goose. And by the end of the weekend, they were life and soul of the party. And we're still friends. We arrived as strangers. And that gives me such... I'd have that in spades over winning the lottery, I think. So one of my favourite things at the moment is... it always has been, is pay it forward. Just be good to people. And if you're good to two people and then they're good to two people else, there's enough hatred and division around at the moment. And I think if people were just nicer to each other, I think that would make the world go around a lot easier. So my life has changed direction. I'm not money focused now. I'm more about what I can give to other people from my personal experiences.
Be wary, Damien. the point at which you say you're not money focused, this is the bit where we're going to ask people for money.
Yes, but that's not for myself. I would like to point out as well that me and my fiance Sue are fully funding this ourselves. We're not using any of the any of the money that we raise isn't going to fund our trip.
The cost of actually making it happen. So if people are donating,
every penny of that will go to the Amputation Foundation, so we can take more people to the Calvert Trust, put people on retraining courses, things like that. So it's not like a freebie holiday where we give 200 quid to the charity and spend £5,000 on the holidays.
I don't think it ever sounded like it was a holiday.
Well, we're thinking of tagging on some time at the end while we're there to maybe go on a safari, because we're right next to the Kenyan National Park, so we may well do that. So every penny that we raise will be spent on the Amputation Foundation, which I found it's made me a better person. After all the bad that's happened to me, I feel in a much more relaxed, comfortable. I'm much more comfortable with who I am and what I want to do for the rest of my life.
Where's the best place to send people who are keen to support you and to donate? So you run it through the My Donate website.
There's the My Donate website, which I think you're going to put up on your social media pages. And that's the quickest way. And if anybody is interested in the Amputation Foundation and the things that we do, there's a website that they can go to, or the Facebook page. If you just type Amputation Foundation into Facebook or Twitter, you'll find our feeds. We do try to keep active on those. So if there's any events or anything coming up, we're doing all kinds of activities, not just climbing mountains or taking people to the Lake District. There's all kinds of things that we do, both for children, families, adults, seniors. We're now starting to branch out. One of our sort of tenets of the organisation is to start trying to rehabilitate people into different careers, potentially, if they want to, because we get a lot of people coming who've been injured doing heavy work, like machinery and things, who, when they can't do that job anymore, they're unskilled for anything else. I'm trying to give them the support and encouragement and payments. We pay for everything. One of our unique selling points is that we pay for any event that we put on. The only cost people incur is generally to and from the event. Everything else is free. We're going to the Royal Court to follow the Yellow Brick Road, Breck Road rather. We're paying for that. We're having a meal, and that's all fully funded by us. We've got one self-employed employee. Our overheads are very low. It's basically just the utilities. So all the money that comes in is going directly out to actually help people and individual people. It's not some sort of political lobby group or anything like that. It's run by amputees for amputees. And we kind of think we're best placed to know what people want to do. And I think that's been borne out by the responses that we've been getting. We recently announced Calvert Trust this year, where we're taking 24 people. And we've been inundated with inquiries already, which is really good.
You're keeping busy. When are you flying to Tanzania?
3rd of October.
Excellent. So you've got plenty of time to get the cash.
Yeah.
My Donate is the website, and we'll get links up on our social media as well, so you can support Damien and his story so far. If you just Google Amputation Foundation, get loads of information about the work that's going on there as well. Damien, it seems like you've got an incredible life, and you know, you seem to be choosing your own path in the way you're doing things now.
Yeah. The flying helped a lot with that because I feel like I'm in control rather than being at the behest of waves and washed around like flotsam and jetsam. One of the things when you're flying is, whether you're an instructor, you have to be clear about when you're handing over control. So the instructors will say, "You have control," and you've got to clearly say, "I have control." And it kind of makes you realise that you're the captain of your soul and master of your own destiny. So try and play an active part in which way you want to go. Just bear with me. But I've got one last thing to say. I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for one very special person, and I hope she's listening. And I just want to say thanks to my wonderful partner, Sue, I'm amazed she's still with me, and she's stuck with me through thick and thin. And there's been a lot of thin, but you don't underestimate how much I appreciate what you've done and what you continue to do for me. Okay?
There we go. Shout out to Sue. He wrote that on his notes. Do not forget at the end.
Cue cards out the window.
Absolutely. Damien, absolute pleasure.
Thank you
for sharing your story. Best of luck with the fundraising as well. We'll catch up in a few months' time, find out how you're getting on as well.
Fab.
Obviously, get the story up on our podcast, and we'll include that in our social media as well. And then, looking forward to the video updates,
Updates. I'll be trying to update what I can so people can see how I'm struggling. But no, I'm determined to do it. There's no way I'm not.
I can already see it's absolutely going to happen, Damien. Yeah. Incredible story. Thank you for sharing it on Radio City Talk. Really appreciate
you joining
us on the program.
Thank you, Mick. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. Damien Harper, you can support his Kilimanjaro Challenger through the Amputation Foundation. My Donate is the website that he's fundraising through as well. We get the all information up on our social media. We are at Radio City Talk.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
On Radio City Talk.